This is me telling you this. The program is Media Network.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archive.
Media Network, a weekly survey of communication developments, hosted by Jonathan Marks.
We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a week or two. Fun and laughter on a summer holiday. No more worries for me or you. For me and you.
Hello, we were planning to sneak off on a little holiday this week, and we were in good company too. President Mikhail Gorbachev, President George Bush, Chancellor Kohl, a lot of people were taking it easy. Late Sunday evening, Soviet broadcaster Vasily Strelnikov was taking it easy during a holiday with friends in Washington, D.C.
We said, let's, for old time's sake, let's switch on the old wireless and see what's happening around the world. And we switched on. We went to Radio Moscow World Service. And my friend says, this frequency is Radio Moscow World Service. And I'm listening in, and it's the top of the hour, and there's this music playing. And, of course, I know how these things work at Radio Moscow. When there's a lot of music at the top of the hour and no news bulletin, that means shit has hit the fan. That's what it turned out to be when Karina Melikyan went on the air a couple of minutes after, past the top of the hour, saying that, you know, what has happened.
This is Radio Moscow World Service. We now bring you Newsflash. Because of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's inability to act as Soviet president, USSR Vice President Gennady Yanayev has taken over presidential powers in the country.
Now, at this point, we could give up and simply get back to our holiday. After all, the 60-hour coup is over, although thousands of questions remain unanswered at this point. Despite what you may be led to believe on the live television news shows, proper analysis does take time. Richard Meesham of BBC Monitoring in Caversham Park, England, has been following the situation closely.
Yes, well, we first noticed something was up at 0300 GMT on the 19th when the Mayak domestic radio service, that's All Union Radio's music and news service, joined up with the main first domestic radio program from Moscow. That was about 5 minutes before TASS put out the item announcing that Gorbachev found it impossible to carry on because of his state of his health. So that was 0300 on the 19th, things started to happen.
And also you noticed on Radio Moscow they started playing music rather than the regular programmes.
Yes, it certainly did affect programming, both domestically and externally. Although on the external service, transmissions have remained on the usual frequencies at the usual times. The main effect was on domestic radio and TV. For the first day, the Mayak Music and News Service was suspended, and there was a main news and music service carrying all the decrees interspersed with music. That lasted for the rest of the day. Domestic radio from Moscow settled back to normal within 24 hours. One interesting thing is that All Union Radio's second program, although it continued to broadcast, failed to carry any programming from Russia's radio. That's the radio service which is in the hands of Boris Yeltsin's people in the Russian Federation.
Yeltsin clearly realized the power of the media. A makeshift solution was prepared.
Some radio amateur equipment was shipped into the Russian Parliament building in Moscow, and that has been on the air since the middle of the day on the 20th of August, and in fact is still on the air on today, Wednesday. And that's a radio amateur setup. They are not only communicating with their supporters outside the parliamentary building, but are also running a radio station using this radio amateur equipment.
Are they also using the ham bands?
Yes, they are indeed. The three main frequencies are 14175 kilohertz, 7045, and 3640 kilohertz. They say give or take a kilohertz or two. Because they will have to move around. And the call sign they're using is Radio 3 Anna, which is phonetics for Radio 3A, Radio 3 Anna. And they say that they're carrying programs of Russia's radio, but they're intermixing that with communications with their supporters in places like Leningrad, etc. So they're using this radio amateur equipment for two purposes, both broadcasting and for communications.
So talking politics, as it were, in the handbands.
Yes, it is. They are indeed.
The station was clearly audible in Hilversum on Wednesday afternoon, around 12 hours UTC on 14175 kHz. The meeting inside the Russian parliament was being relayed live, with speakers complaining that news they were hearing from foreign radio stations didn't match what they were hearing from Soviet radio. Today, our country has been struck by a new disaster, said the speaker. A criminal gang has seized power. The power of the president of the USSR and the Russian government is threatened. Blood is flowing in the country. We hear sounds of automatic rifles. And yet, at 15 hours UTC on Wednesday, both state radio and television had changed sides. But what about the other private and commercial stations in the USSR? In Moscow, six stations were operating up to Monday morning. How did the coup affect them? As well as medium wave, Echo of Moscow has a 100 kilowatt shortwave transmitter located south of Moscow, with an antenna beamed northwest. Vasily Strelnikov has done weekly programs for that station.
At around 10 minutes to 8 Moscow time, during the early morning broadcast, at least two unidentified men entered the studio and requested to see the director general, Sergei Korzun. When they met with him, they told him to go off the air. His reply was something of the nature that, I do not know you, who you bozos are, and I intend to stay on the air. They said, okay, fine. The bottom line is that a few minutes later, the station went off the air. The feed from the studio to the transmitter was cut off. The only other station that went off the air, and this is according to the information that I'm getting from Moscow, the only other station that went off the air for no apparent reason was the station run by rock promoter Stas Namen, the station known as SNC on 1260 kilohertz. Apart from that, the French Soviet station, the Soviet-French station, Europe Plus, is still on the air.
Information as to what's happened to the private FM stations around the country since the coup collapsed is still sketchy on this Thursday as we compile this edition of the programme. The ban on the media imposed on Monday, though, has been lifted. Despite Monday's problems, Echo of Moscow came back on the air much quicker than expected. Thanks to that shortwave transmitter, it made it possible to check from monitoring posts here in Western Europe.
It was closed down on the 19th of August, but it seemed to have got back on the air within 24 hours and is still broadcasting. It certainly was still broadcasting on the morning of the 21st of August, and that's on 9535 kilohertz.
Don't you get a lot of interference from Swiss Radio International?
Yes, unfortunately, because of interference, we couldn't really use the signal to actually monitor what they were actually saying.
But you know it's on the air.
But it certainly is on the air.
And what times, roughly?
The times for Echo of Moscow are from 04 to 07 GMT and from 15 to 19 GMT.
OK. Now, as far as the Republican stations are concerned, in the various Soviet republics, who controls what, as it were? I know, is Vladivostok still in the hands of the Boris Yeltsin supporters?
Yes, Vladivostok Radio was still operating on the morning of Wednesday, the 21st of August, carrying pro-Yeltsin material. As for the Soviet republics, they're certainly on the air, and that does include Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia.
On Monday night, Radio Tallinn had its usual weekly English broadcast on 5925 kilohertz. Amazing, bearing in mind what was going on in Moscow.
Hopefully you can join us.
Radio Riga on nearby 5935 kHz was active on Monday night and last night again, but the English news bulletins at 2030 UTC failed to appear. Stations in Eastern Europe were concerned about the situation. On Monday, Radio Prague had a poignant reminder.
This news came just 2 days before the 23rd anniversary of the Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia. In this news broadcast, we'll catalogue the reaction in Czechoslovakia.
One regular Media Network listener was closer to the action than we were and could hear the action from the Baltic on medium wave. He went to a phone box late Tuesday evening and called Hilversum 724-222, our answer line.
Hello, Jonathan. This is Julius Hermans. I'm on holiday in Sweden at the moment, and last night, of course, I tuned in to radio stations from the Baltic countries. Tonight, Tuesday night at 9:30 p.m., Radio Vilnius came on two frequencies only, 1557, and much stronger here on 1107. No shortwave frequencies were noted, just as last night, Monday night, I did not notice any shortwave frequencies. Also, the program was suddenly interrupted at 21:46 to give messages in Lithuania on the situation in Moscow. Radio Vilnius noted that the Soviets put Soviet transmitters on their frequency to Chenden, and I noticed that on Monday night when a Russian transmitter was heard on 1557 as well.
Well, we checked last night, Wednesday, at 22:30 UTC, for the English broadcast from Radio Vilnius beamed to North America, but no shortwave signal was noted at all. In fact, over the past few weeks, the number of Soviet transmitters carrying the program has gradually gone down, until in the middle of last week, no shortwave was left at all. In the last few days, Western news agencies have carried conflicting reports about whether the broadcasting stations in the Baltic states have been taken over. Richard Meesham again.
Well, yes, and also the fact that taking over a studio doesn't actually put a radio station off the air, because it's the transmitter that's the important thing. And, of course, the Baltic states obviously learnt their lesson back in January with the takeover of the radio and TV centre in Vilnius, and all three of them have got standby arrangements. We monitored a broadcast from Riga on the 20th of August saying that they were now broadcasting from a small studio, and apologise for listeners for poorer sound quality than usual. So obviously they're broadcasting from standby studios. But the good thing is that the transmitters, or some of the medium-wave transmitters, are still in the hands of the Republican authorities.
Western broadcasters didn't have much time to change their transmission schedules. US-financed Radio Liberty out of Munich already broadcasts round the clock in Russian. On Tuesday, the BBC added 15 minutes to its Russian-language output, and earlier today combined all the transmissions into one of 17 and a half hours. Voice of America put on extra frequencies beamed to the USSR, introducing Russian newscasts at the top of every hour. And yesterday, Radio Sweden started a breakfast broadcast to the Baltic states.
Between 7 and 7:15 UTC, Radio Sweden will transmit 3 5-minute news bulletins in Estonian, Latvian and Lithuanian. The frequency is 6065 kHz on the shortwave.
So how did Radio Moscow World Service fare in all of this from its 10-storey building in the heart of the Soviet capital? It was during Tuesday that it first carried reports about opposition to the coup. That was in sharp contrast to the television news, which only changed sides in the middle of Wednesday afternoon, European time.
To all at Radio Nederland, hey, a very Merry Christmas and a very special New Year. Hey, guys, I got your QSL card just recently.
Okay.
Vasily's Weekend, Radio Moscow, and you're listening to Vasily's Christmas Special.
If the name Vasily Strelnikov is familiar to you, it's probably because his program of rock music and offbeat comments, which started 2 years ago on Radio Moscow, was a sign of human life, and that perestroika was allowing people to loosen up instead of the scripted ad-libs we'd heard for years.
Well, I guess Vasily's Weekend became possible thanks to perestroika, because in the first place, if Listener's Request Club was only on the air once every 2 weeks, and the copy had to be signed by six different people before I could actually submit it to tape, Vasily's Weekend was on the air every week, and it played rock and roll music, and the only signature that had to go on the copy was from the guy that just listened to it when it was already on tape before it went on the air. As a rule, there were no amendments or changes. And, of course, the listeners noticed it, and we started getting a lot of mail.
That's very encouraging. You also started a telephone line, too.
That's right, before my answering machine was stolen.
It was stolen?
It was in my office at Radio Moscow, and then it was there for about 6 months till somebody noticed it, and one morning I come in and it's just not there.
But did this procedure of getting lots of signatures before a program was broadcast just apply to his program?
No, that was a standard practice for every program at Radio Moscow, including music programs, rock and roll programs like I did. A couple of signatures went from people that thought they knew everything about music, especially rock and roll music, and basically what they did know was that rock and roll was decadent. It was evil. It was coming from the West. So in order to get something like Pink Floyd, The Wall, on the air, I would have to explain that it's actually an anti-war song or protest song. And if I could convince this person, then I would get the signature and I'd be more or less halfway on the way to airing the program. So it's really bizarre.
What about the news? Under normal circumstances, we know that the Kremlin chimes are now live. But what about those news bulletins?
The news is recorded. Unless, of course, there is a news story that is breaking, a story that is originating in the Soviet Union, and not only, but when Radio Moscow feels that it can cover the story, that goes out live.
For example, the recent summit meeting, for instance.
Exactly.
Mind you, the economic problems in the USSR have been reflected inside the station, too.
A while back, there were something like 69 languages that Radio Moscow was covering. But then there is a thing called cutbacks. We all know what happened to CBC and, I mean, Radio Canada International. That is affecting Radio Moscow also. So a lot of these language services are being cut. So there are a lot less people at Radio Moscow now than there were before.
You might ask how someone gets into Soviet external broadcasting, especially English service. Vasily's story is simple. He took a voice test and 2 hours later was reading the news.
I was born in New York and spent my childhood in Washington, D.C. And I'd find myself carrying around an AM radio, listening to all these local radio stations, and of course watching local television. I was always into that thing. While my classmates were all set on becoming diplomats, doctors, and lawyers, I always wanted to be a DJ. And then in 1973, I started listening to shortwave. And of course, one of the first radio stations that I picked up was Radio Nederland. And that just did it for me. I fell in love with shortwave. And I guess that's why I'm in the business now.
But how did you get to Moscow? Because you said you grew up in Washington.
Right. Well, my parents, my father was a correspondent for the Soviet national daily Pravda. In other words, my father and my mother are Russians. They're Soviet citizens. And my father was stationed in New York and then D.C. Nobody asked me. I just sort of got there.
Life in Moscow was very different in 1975, though.
Of course, I didn't know what I was getting into. I thought that radio was just as good as anywhere else in the world, and the rest of the world for me was D.C. Having switched on my radio in Moscow back then, the only thing that I could hear was some communist radio station speaking about the glorious past and present of the farmers and workers, and there was no other type of radio. Now, of course, I'm witness to these different radio stations, commercial radio stations going up in Moscow on FM and AM. This was something I could not even dream of back then.
For decades, it's become clear that listeners in the Soviet Union have relied on Western broadcasters to fill in the news, not broadcast by the state media.
Of course, people that have a knowledge of shortwave would certainly switch on their wirelesses and go to stations like Radio Free Europe, the BBC, the VOA in Russian. And a lot of people, of course, know the English language.
Amongst the younger people, you mean?
Exactly, yes.
And is it easy to get hold of a shortwave radio? I mean, I was in Prague, last year, and walked through the shops, and you could buy some Soviet radios, but they were fast disappearing and being replaced by ones from Taiwan. What about the Soviet Union?
Well, you still really can't buy any radio sets or communication sets or whatever coming from Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, or anything. The radios that are manufactured in the Soviet Union seem to be going for export. Now, the funny thing is, when Gorbachev came to power and jamming disappeared, the radios also disappeared from the shops. Now, whether it was caused by everyone running to the shops to get radios, or it was a cleverly masterminded sort of a plan on the part of the government, that still remains a mystery. But the bottom line is that there are practically no radios in the stores.
However, you don't need a shortwave wireless to hear Radio Moscow in the capital itself.
Yes, you can, on 918 kilohertz. It's a transmitter which is located outside of Moscow and beams to Moscow for correspondents, diplomats, businessmen that might be in Moscow at that time. At least that was the idea when the transmitter was being set up, when the World Service was being set up in the late 70s.
Oh, Monday morning, couldn't guarantee that Monday evening you would still be here with me. Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way.
In Western Europe, we tend to have a static picture of the Soviet state media. Yet, if you look closely, you'll find plenty of examples of human nature shining through the political rhetoric. Sometimes the human element is forgotten by Western analysts. Vasily explains how he tuned into a European shortwave radio station's current affairs program to discover his way of reading the news had been misinterpreted by Western monitors.
The way the news works at Radio Moscow is that the news has to be 10 minutes, 40 seconds long. Of course, the way I read more or less in a faster tempo than most other news readers for Radio Moscow, and I just run out of copy before 10:40 is there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So what I do is, what would be the normal practice at Radio Moscow, you get the copy for the previous news bulletin and pick up the news items at the very end, the tail bit of the previous newscast, and read these news items, which are, you know, they're neutral in their content. They're mostly news about the Soviet Union. So for about 2 days in a row, or 3 days in a row, I kept running out of copy, and I kept going to the previous newscast, and I kept reading a news item about the writers' union in Moscow forming their own independent union. Because, I mean, I had nothing better to read.
Meanwhile, in Western Europe, experts were sitting in studios analyzing why this story had been around for 72 hours.
Is this a sign that something is happening at Radio Moscow, or is the writers' union being incorporated into Radio Moscow? We asked our Soviet broadcasting affairs specialist, and they had a whole big thing about it. Well, actually, I had nothing better to read.
We've got the world talking. Radio Netherlands.
Well, next from the Netherlands, we can also solve a mystery dating back to 1983. You may remember newsreader Vladimir Danchev, a Radio Moscow announcer and party member for 20 years, who, for what appears to be personal reasons, decided to change the copy he was supposed to read on the air. In a news broadcast, he referred to Soviet occupants in Afghanistan instead of the limited contingent forces.
Back then, the news was read live every hour. And there was a person that they call a controller sitting in the control room making sure what the announcer was reading in English corresponded to the Russian copy. In other words, the centralized news department writes the news and then distributes it to all the different language services, which then translate it from Russian to their respective language. So the controller was there to make sure that everything was going well, everything corresponded to the Russian copy. But the way things were that those days, the controllers didn't really pay much attention to their jobs. They weren't really too serious about it, because they were college kids, freelancing.
Yeah.
And Vladimir Danchev made sure that the controller was in the coffee shop or in the snack bar when he was reading the news. So he would look out from the studio through the window and see, aha, the controller is not there. And that's when he read the stuff that he did. And nobody knew about it because the sound engineer doesn't know English. So he kept reading it. Nobody would notice it. And when the controller was in there, he would read the way it was on paper, on copy. A couple of weeks later, Radio Moscow World Service learns from the wire services that hell broke out at Radio Moscow World Service. But at the moment, you might be interested, the guy is working for the letters department at Radio Tashkent.
This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch international... What? Service.
Media Network. No sodium, no calcium, no sugar, no nonsense. Just plenty of source material.
There have been some isolated reports of Soviet jamming on shortwave over the last few days. Some of it clearly happened, as in the case of Radio Vilnius. In fact, it's ironic that a couple of weeks back, Radio Vilnius's English program talked about the jamming stations and how they'd been dismantled. Here's a summary of what was said, because the reception quality at the time is too poor to rebroadcast.
The jamming of foreign radio stations in the Soviet Union and Lithuania was officially discontinued on the 13th of November 1988. In the Cold War era, the Soviet Union had actually coined a special term to denote its jamming activities. It was known as radio defense. In Lithuania, there were five jamming stations situated in the major cities, including Vilnius and Kaunas. Each station was equipped with about 10 to 15 shortwave transmitters, the majority of which had an output power of 5 kilowatts. Horizontal or vertical dipole antennas were most often used, giving jamming coverage within a 30-kilometer radius. In other words, these local jamming stations were designed to jam Western broadcasters in the immediate vicinity of the transmitter, so-called ground wave. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union is known to have had a host of much more powerful jammers. They bounce their signals off the ionosphere, and so a transmitter site was designed to jam signals in an area some 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers away.
In Lithuania, each jamming station was manned by around 20 people. As soon as jamming officially ended in the country, part of the staff who were of retirement age were dismissed, while the remainder were given new jobs within the framework of the Ministry of Communications.
In these difficult times, in view of the fact that Soviet troops have seized both Lithuania's radio and television broadcasting stations in Vilnius, there are people who say that we shouldn't have been so hasty in dismantling the jammers, since their antenna towers could have been easily used for putting up an emergency television and radio antenna. But who could have foreseen such a turn of events back in 1989?
Indeed. But wait, there's more.
Not far from Vilnius, towards the northeast, in the direction of the Lithuanian-Belarusian border, there's the small village of Berzak. Driving past it in the car, you can see eight antennas covering an area of approximately 10 acres. The largest of them all, a truly impressive structure, is a 20-element twin Yagi Russian BF-2 antenna, which is adapted to operate on the shortwave bands. This particular field of antennas and adjacent buildings was used as a reception centre by the Ministry of Communications. Because even though foreign broadcasts had to be jammed, the government officials wanted to know what Western broadcasters were saying. Thus, highly directional antennas had to be used to minimise the blanket jamming that another part of the same Soviet ministry was putting on the air. The next day, all the texts of the monitored programmes would be delivered to highly placed officials in the central headquarters of the Communist Party, the propaganda department of the Council of Ministers, and so on.
But during this week's coup, what happened to the former jamming transmitters in the Moscow area? Were they reactivated? Richard Meesham of BBC Monitoring again.
The transmitters in the Moscow area, which were given over to Republican radio so that all the republics could be better heard outside the republics themselves, actually ceased carrying any broadcasts from the republics and had been given over to broadcast from Moscow.
A situation that's probably now been reversed. We end this survey with a clip from Radio Moscow at the end of the 15 hours UTC news on Wednesday.
Those are the headlines, and to end the news, here's an announcement. The leadership and the many thousands of employees of the USSR National Television and Radio Broadcasting Company have offered their apologies to the public for having been unable to conform to their professional duties due to strict control that existed over the past 3 days.
That says it all. We're back in 7 days. Let's all have a peaceful weekend. And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 idents and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues, and a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxer.ca. Good listening, everyone.
This is PCJ Radio.